This is Central Time. President Biden is set to deliver his first address to a joint session of Congress tonight. He's expected to announce plans for a long list of proposals. That includes a continuation of the expanded child tax credit and a national paid family and medical leave program. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What priorities do you hope Biden lays out in his speech tonight? Do you want to see this expanded child tax credit continue? We talked about that on the show yesterday. Are you concerned about the cost of what the president has been calling for? And what do you think of President Biden's first 100-ish days on the job? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Domenico Montanaro is a senior political editor and correspondent for NPR. Domenico, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, thank you for having me on.
Well, give us a sneak preview here, Domenico. What are we expecting to hear from the president as he goes before Congress tonight?
Well, you know, the speech is expected to be, roughly 5,000 words or so, which is times out to about an hour. So I think that'll be around how long it is. And we're probably not going to get the same amount of, you know, applause breaks that we would in other years, because there's probably going to be fewer people in the audience today because of COVID-19 and spacing issues. So that'll be interesting to see. On policy, you know, he has his infrastructure bill that he believes will burnish his legacy if it gets passed, that it could be transformational for the country. Of course, it's controversial among moderates and among Republicans. He still has some work to do, Biden, that is, with even a couple moderate members of his own party to be able to pay for what's in the legislation. And of course, Republicans don't believe things like electric charging stations should be in an infrastructure bill. And Biden argues that, you know, 200 years ago, railroads weren't considered traditional infrastructure either. So, you know, we have this war of ideology, so to speak, about what the country should do, what it should spend money on. And, you know, I think there's going to be a list of priorities, you know, that Biden's going to look at the coronavirus pandemic. He gets good marks for his handling of that. So expect a little bit of touting some of what he's been able to do with the vaccination rollout. And, you know, he's probably going to push for an immigration overhaul, something that he sent to Congress on his first day. That's a more vulnerable area for him, given the surge at the U.S., given the surge at the southern U.S. border. And he's even going to make a call for things like bringing back the assault rifle ban and the and a high capacity magazine ban, something that happened in 1994 but was sunset in 2004. So quite the list of things. We know all of them are not going to get done. Presidents essentially get 1 year of stuff and then defending it after that, given how quickly elections start.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Jonathan is with us in Eau Claire. Jonathan, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What do you want to bring up, Jonathan?
Well, I guess as far as expenditures go, or the costs of Biden's proposals, we need to very quickly look at the cost of things like tax cuts, but it's always brought up as how much is this going to cost when it comes to actual expenditures. So really, I'm less concerned about what his proposals will cost in terms of actual spending, because we're actually going to see some intangible from it, whereas these last wave of tax cuts, less so.
Jonathan, thanks a lot for the call. And Domenico, there's been a lot of comparing and contrasting of the Republican-backed tax cuts in 2017 and what they cost in terms of the federal budget, the deficit, versus the expenditures that the president is proposing here. What kind of things are you hearing?
Well, and I think what the caller is getting at there is that, you know, paying for certain programs does have a degree of investment, Democrats would argue, that you get something for the money, that there's a return on investment in, say, starting, universal pre-K, so that because children 0 to 5, all the research shows if you start in an abyss at 5, then you have a much more difficult time kind of getting out of it than other kids who are of some socioeconomic means who get into good preschools at 3 or 4. So this would, you know, try to bridge that gap and have kids of some need to, you know, get into free pre-K so that everybody in the country can get into pre-K at 3 or 4 years old. And then on the opposite end of that, have at least 2 years of community college for free as a bridge for some of those folks to be able to get into potentially higher education than that, or, you know, in a vocational program. So, you know, it's hard to, I'm not an economist, you know, I'm not able to sort of figure out the exact amount, but I think that that's what your caller's getting at there, because, you know, part of this family's plan, it's $1 trillion in quote unquote spending, and then about $800 billion in tax cuts. So it's not purely tax cuts. It does have obviously some money spent on what the Biden administration would consider investments.
Thanks a lot for that call. We'll go to Nate now in Milwaukee. Nate, hello.
Hi, thank you for having me. I got to say that while I don't think any politician is perfect, and that includes Biden, I am pretty happy with much of the job he's done so far. Not every single little thing, but most things. He's made sure the vaccines got out there, and I got vaccinated recently. Also, with the global warming, which is basically a looming problem for the U.S. and the rest of the world, he has been trying to deal with things in a positive way, not only focus on the positive, but try to deal with something that basically is going to be waves of damage coming down on the economy in different ways. And the people complaining about dealing with global warming are actually opposed to the free market, because in the free market, you actually pay for your own damages. And in the U.S., they're sheltered from that. And
he's thanks a lot for the call, Nate. And Domenico, you did a piece looking at the first 100 days of the Biden administration, 100-ish, and comparing what they've done, the Biden administration, with their promises. And Nate hit on one of the things you looked at, vaccine distribution, something the president's gotten fairly high marks in polling on. What are we seeing out there?
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, almost 40% of the country, 40% of adults have gotten vaccinated. And, you know, that's a good sign, but it's not quite at, you know, the level that scientists say would reach herd immunity, something in the 70 to 75% range. And when there was this first initial rush of people trying to get vaccines, and it was very difficult to get appointments. Now we're starting to see a little bit of a glut and some hesitancy. So there's a push now, this second sort of phase of this, to get those who are hesitant to get vaccinated. And there's, you know, polling has shown something like 60 to 70% of people say that they've either gotten vaccinated or they will get vaccinated. That's still not quite high enough. So there's still a bit of a hurdle to go before everything can get back to normal. But again, Biden does get pretty high marks for what they've been able to do so far on the coronavirus. I think the number one part of that the Biden administration would argue is that they've had a very disciplined message rollout on all of these things. And Republican strategists who I talked to who've been around for a very long time are envious of just how on message they've been on most things. Now, I can't say the same on their immigration strategy, which they've struggled with, but on the coronavirus and on infrastructure, you know, they said that they wish that President Trump had taken a similarly disciplined approach and maybe they would have gotten more done.
We're talking to Domenico Montanaro, senior political editor and correspondent for NPR. He's with us today to talk about what we expect to hear from President Biden in his address before Congress tonight and to take a look at the president's first 100 days in office. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What has stood out to you for better or worse in the first few months of the Biden administration? What do you give him good marks on? What would you like to see more from, or maybe less from, the president on? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about President Biden and his first 100 days in office. Domenico Montanaro is with us from NPR. You can join in if you have thoughts at 800-642-1234. Domenico, we just talked about a place where the president's getting high marks, vaccines and COVID-19. And you just started to touch on immigration, where in polling, people don't seem to buy into what the presidential administration is doing. And on a practical level, there's been criticism that they didn't seem to be prepared for what they were going to face. Could you talk about that issue?
Yeah, there are a lot of things that he'd promised to do, you know, and he did introduce legislation for a pathway to citizenship for immigrants in the U.S. illegally on his first day. That's something he promised to do. But that's, you know, sort of the easy box check thing to do, because then it's very difficult to get a massive overhaul through Congress these days. You know, it was in 2013, I covered the immigration fight then, and it got 68 votes from senators and it couldn't pass the House. And I think that that makes a lot of Republicans in particular who might cross the aisle to try and work on something like this very, very skittish to do anything. So, you know, it's been much easier for Republicans to criticize Biden and Democrats on immigration because former President Trump made it such a hardline issue. And it really has become a third rail in Republican Party politics. So it makes it difficult to get something done there. But on an administrative level, still, even there, you know, Americans are pretty sour on how Biden has done so far with that. Our latest poll had him at about 34% approval rating for his handling of immigration. And, you know, Democrats were upset with him, too, on how he handled the refugee situation. For example, he promised to raise the cap of refugees, which is separate from immigration. It's a different vetting process, different offices that deal with that. But the Biden administration decided to keep the cap essentially for a while and then walked it back because they said they need the personnel to deal with the immigration situation at the border. So, you know, there's a lot of pieces of this that are very complicated that they've had a very difficult time dealing with. I think that the public will give Biden probably some space to be able to say these plans that he's putting into place to, quote unquote, fix what Trump had done, to build better facilities, to be able to house more people who are coming over, people seeking asylum, etc. But, you know, eventually he's going to really own that issue if it's not handled well, you know, in a few months.
I want to take our last minute or two, Domenico, to talk about an interview you did with the director of a new documentary about the QAnon conspiracy theory. Huge story. I mean, we could talk about it for hours, but what kind of things did you find out from this documentary and the director about this long-running and odd conspiracy theory?
Well, super interesting, you know, and he said that he doesn't think that it's because of QAnon that January 6th happened, but it wouldn't have happened without QAnon, you know. And it's interesting because he gives very strong evidence to suggest who Q was, and this individual is just an administrator of one of the dark web internet chat rooms and really had no real ties to anyone high up in the Trump administration. And, you know, he hopes that by unmasking this person and the kind of he called dorkiness behind the scenes of who was really pulling the strings on this, that maybe the folks who believed in this false conspiracy would maybe back off of it a little bit and that maybe they would start talking to family members again. And he said he has heard from some of those family members who've been able to reconnect with their families and hopes that that continues.
We'll leave it there for now. Domenico, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, thanks for having me. It was fun.
That's Domenico Montanaro, senior political editor and correspondent for NPR. He was with us today to talk about President Biden's first 100 days in office and to preview Biden's first address to a joint session of Congress. That address, by the way, starts tonight at 8. You can hear live NPR coverage of the speech, plus the Republican response from South Carolina Senator Tim Scott. All of that will be here on the Ideas Network. That's tonight at 8 on Wisconsin Public Radio and at WPR.org. Next up, we'll look at the potential environmental impact of planting trees after the governor directed the DNR to plant 75 million of them in the state by 2030. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. On Earth Day, Governor Evers issued an executive order directing the Department of Natural Resources to plant 75 million trees in Wisconsin by 2030. Some research supports planting trees as an effective way of capturing CO2 in the atmosphere. But it's not necessarily the main solution for another big environmental problem, deforestation. And scientists say reducing greenhouse gases that we emit in the first place should also be part of the solution. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the governor's plan to plant millions of trees aimed at capturing carbon emissions? Should planting trees be part of the global response to climate change? Where do you want to see new trees in the state? And what questions do you have? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Adina Rissman is a professor of forest and wildlife ecology at UW-Madison. Adina, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
75 million sounds like a lot of trees to me. Adina, does this seem like a realistic goal of planting this many trees by 2030?
You know, I think it can be realistic. I think it's an exciting goal. It is maybe a stretch goal, maybe a little bit ambitious, but I think it can be done.
Is this something that really does put a dent in climate change, all these trees absorbing all that CO2?
Well, it's one of the important things that we can do, but it's certainly not the only thing that needs to be done. Many scientists have run different models and come up with different estimates for how much we can reduce climate change emissions and improve our climate through natural climate solutions like planting trees. And the estimates vary, but it seems like maybe we could do 10, 20, 30% of what we need to do by how we treat the natural world. And tree planting is an important part of that.
Where in Wisconsin do you see some elbow room where a lot of trees could go?
Well, great question. I think one of the great things about trees is that they're good for us in the natural world in so many ways. Trees, as we're talking about here, can help store and sequester carbon. They also support the timber industry, which is primarily focused in northern and central Wisconsin. We have a $24 billion timber industry in the state, which many people don't know. We also have an $18 billion outdoor recreation industry, and that's really statewide. And trees can benefit farmers. You know, over half of farmers have woodlands on their lands, and that's throughout the state, but more in central and southern Wisconsin. And trees also really benefit people in urban areas. And we know that there's a real issue with tree equity, that lower income neighborhoods have fewer trees. And so really these trees can go throughout the state for a lot of different uses.
In our article, a news article at WPR.org, a lot of listeners commented, you know, I like this okay, but we've got a lot of deer in our neck of the woods, mostly northern Wisconsin, and the kind of trees we want to plant, it's kind of hard to protect them from deer. Do you see that kind of logistical challenge in getting trees planted and taking successfully in certain parts of the state?
Sure. Yeah, good question. There's definitely going to be logistical challenges along the way here, from the capacity and budget to do it, to questions of are those trees in the right place and are they the right species to grow there? And then are they going to live? You know, and deer are certainly an issue for seedlings to be able to live and persist. So this is one of the reasons it's really important for landowners to consult a forestry professional, make sure if they're going to plant trees, they really think about those questions. Is it in the right place? Is it the right tree species? Are they protecting the trees in some kind of way with a sleeve or other way to keep deer from browsing that tree right away?
We're talking to Adina Risman, professor of forest and wildlife ecology at UW-Madison, looking at tree planting in Wisconsin. The governor called for 75 million trees to be planted in the state by 2030, part of the goal there to help tackle climate change by capturing carbon. Adina, can you give us a sense of the state of our forests here in Wisconsin, how old they are? What is our current stock?
Yeah, great question. So we do have, I would say, a predominance of middle-aged trees in Wisconsin. We don't have a lot of older trees that are maybe older than 80 years old. We don't have a lot of really young trees that are maybe, you know, 20, 30 years old. And so we have an opportunity to really diversify our tree species. And that's especially important because we have a lot of issues coming up that are taking out some of our trees. We've lost a lot of ash to emerald ash borer. We've seen a lot of other insects and diseases come through Wisconsin. And, you know, unfortunately, that trend is probably not going to go away. So we really need to also be aggressive about continuing to invest in diversifying our forests to make sure that we still have a really nice set of trees in our woods and in our cities that can provide for a lot of different forest products and that can also provide wildlife habitat, that plant diversity, beautiful places for outdoor recreation, water quality, and so much more.
How do we end up with this, I don't know, baby boom of trees where all of them are middle-aged now? I mean, I get probably a lot of the older growth was harvested in the logging days, but why do we have this this preponderance of middle-aged trees.
Yeah, that's right. We had really the cutover in the logging era when most of our trees were harvested. And then we had this period of a lot of fires, agricultural conversion of land. And then in, let's say, kind of the 20s, 30s, 40s, a lot of those areas started to come back into trees. Some of them have been harvested. So we have, these rotations of trees where they have stayed more middle age. And some of it is that result of history. And so we have ended up in a place where we're now looking for increasing this diversity. And one of the other key points about planting trees is we want to make sure not to put them in certain areas that might not be the best place for trees. When you look at the state of Wisconsin, we've lost some forest land, but we've lost a huge amount of our grassland and our barrens, our open lands. And so we want to make sure not to put trees in those lands that are also really important for other wildlife, agricultural or other recreation uses that really should not have trees planted in them.
And we've been talking about planting trees. What about our existing forests? Are we doing a good job of preserving what we have right now?
Well, one of the other exciting parts about this proposal is that it also has a commitment to conserve 125,000 acres of existing forests. And this conservation of forest land is another important component of the efforts that we have in Wisconsin to keep forests as forests. We've done a lot of conservation projects over the decades, and this is an effort to grow on what are really fairly bipartisan efforts to ensure this forest land that is both industrial forests that can continue to be a base of forest products to keep our mills going, that also provides all the other benefits of forests, wildlife, water quality, recreation, and carbon storage.
Let's bring on a caller now. Andy is on the line in Madison. Andy, hi.
Hi. It's good to be on the show.
What do you want to bring up, Andy?
Well, I just wanted to ask your guest if there are some perceived plans to educate cities about tree planting in urban settings. I've had some conversations with City of Madison Forestry and have really come up a lot against a lot of resistance about planting native trees, canopy trees. The trend has been to plant even invasives like Bradford pear, which is actually really detrimental to our ecosystems, and hoping some education could be filtered down to cities.
Andy, thanks a lot for the call. Your thoughts on that, Adina, the kinds of trees we're choosing to plant in our urban areas?
Definitely. So cities are really important decision makers in making these choices about the types of trees. And, you know, they are taking public input, but clearly, you know, not everybody ends up agreeing about the kinds of trees. You know, Bradford pears may certainly have very beautiful aspects to them. In other places, we are seeing native trees going in, like hackberries. So, you know, there's an oaks. So there's a real variety. I think cities are often aiming more for diversity, having learned, I think, some of the lessons from Dutch elm disease that took out the big elms in the 50s and 60s, and then emerald ash borer that took out many of our ash. Cities are now really taking that message to plant a variety. And I think in order to encourage this, there are some grant programs like the Urban Forest Community Grants that really will help accelerate the planting of trees and hopefully diverse trees, including our natives.
Thanks for that call. Adina, in our last minute or so, is there a policy you'd particularly like to see at the state or even federal level that might help us make smart decisions about planting trees?
Yeah, thanks. So one of the things that has been discussed a lot recently is the next upcoming budget in Wisconsin, and whether there will be funds for things like the Knowles Nelson Stewardship Fund, which is really needed to, if we want to have this goal of conserving forests and keeping forests as forests. And also a question is of whether we'll see that increased funding for Wisconsin forest landowner and urban forestry grants. And, you know, one thing I think we really need to think about is that as we see these increasing disasters and disturbances, that impacts our ability to put trees on the ground. We didn't have any trees go out last year because of COVID. But that's changing, and hopefully we'll see that accelerating.
Adina, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me on the show.
That's Adina Rispin, professor of forest and wildlife ecology at UW-Madison. She joined us for a look at Governor Evers' call to plant 75 million trees in Wisconsin by the year 2030. Coming up, data from the U.S. Census is coming out. We'll talk about what it means and which states will gain or lose seats in Congress. What's that going to mean for the control of Congress and for presidential races in the future? We'll check it out coming up.